Well, it's good to have you back. The last time you were here talking to me, we were talking about Preetzi's honor.
Yes.
And we chatted for a long time. We talked about your days in Ireland and overseas and some of your early career.
Yes.
You're moving to Dallas, where I think your daughter was living.
Your daughter, and now I have two grandchildren there. I have a young man who was, when we moved there, he was 13, and he's now joined the Army.
He was 13?
Yeah.
That was 1980 when you moved there.
Yes.
Well, you've had 6 years in Dallas now. What, you must be a real Texan by now, huh?
Funny thing, my daughter's been there for about 12 years, and she has a particular friend who one night said to her, "Wendy, I hate to say this to you, but you'll never be a Texan." And that probably goes for me, too, because I hardly ever leave the house. You see, we got into that thing overseas where my wife and my girls all spoke the language, and I didn't, so that I didn't have that obligation of going to dinner parties and cocktail parties, and I got out of the habit.
You're talking about Spain now.
No, I'm talking about all of them. about seven countries.
Well, what's Dallas seems like a relatively unlikely literary community. I assume that is the case. But
oh, they're a fierce literary community.
Oh, is it?
Oh, fierce. They, as a matter of fact, on the North American continent, there's only one community which is more of a culture freak, and that's Toronto. In Dallas, they're just as keen on writers and writing as they are about their museums and orchestras and ballet associations. It's really freaked out.
No, it's a big reading town then, huh?
Oh, very much so. Oh, very much so.
A lot of bookstores?
About 11. Now, that's not counting things like paperback outlets, such as supermarkets, but they have about 11 legitimate bookstores.
Do you, who are some of the writers beside yourself who live in the Dallas area?
Well, let's see. Gosh, I wish I could remember offhand. And they just don't come to mind.
But there's no meeting place like, say, Elaine's or New York.
Oh, it wouldn't matter anyway. I mean, I just don't leave the house. That's the fact of it. And so since I don't get into that community, I have a little bit more of a difficulty in remembering the names of the writers.
Well, besides, it's too hot to leave the house too much.
Oh, well, we just left the summer for 3 months because it runs to about 108 degrees.
Well, my father lives in Houston, and so do a number of my relatives there. And matter of fact, I grew up in Houston, and so before the days of air conditioning, I might add.
Oh, my.
And I didn't notice. I was just a kid, and during the early 1940s, and I didn't know that you were supposed to have air conditioning, and we had screened-in porches and ran around half-naked. All of the kids did in the neighborhood.
But I think that's part of when they say you're not going to be a Texan is that you can't stand the heat.
Well, when I go back now, I can't stand it.
No.
It's just the difference between the air-conditioned car and the air-conditioned shopping mall and the air-conditioned home is so extreme that I notice the heat more, and it's so humid. Well, we want to talk a little more about you. You say you never leave the house to speak of, but I assume that's because you're so busy writing and turning out all these wonderful books.
Oh, well, you know, a funny thing, I have to just sort of punctuate the not leaving the house. We have a car that's now 6 years old, and it has 10,000 miles on it, because we take these long tours to the supermarket. That's about what ran up the mileage on the car.
Which is about half a mile away, probably.
Just about, yeah, sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Preetzi family. I assume I'm pronouncing it correctly, because I did see the movie. And, of course, when I did the book, I think I was calling it Preetzi, but it doesn't really matter, does it?
Oh, not a bit. I should think that anywhere outside of Italy, you would say Preetzi. And Preetzi is the Italian pronunciation.
Have you? Now, you're obviously not Italian. Condon sounds more like an Irish name to me.
Yeah, we were Scotch-Irish.
Scotch-Irish. Have you had any flack from the Italian community over your characterization of this mafia family?
Oh, not a bit. I think, for one thing, that in these Prezi books, they're far more humorous seeming than they are in life, and they're slightly more personally romantic, even if their lives are not romantic. No, I would say, by and large, that for one thing, the two groups of people that I know that have great respect for writers are the citizens of the Republic of Ireland and Sicilians, and they both share a kind of what might be called a peasant background, and the idea of a man that can write a book, he's some kind of an intellectual, which to me is kind of brings on the giggles.
Well, the wonderful thing about the Prezi books is your sense of humor. It's the Godfather with a sense of humor. There's a black humor involved, but I would be reading along even some of the more harrowing scenes, and I would burst out laughing. You know, you're not really supposed to laugh when I'm having mental blocks. Charlie goes down to Miami to lay low the five guys there, and he uses the cyanide bomb. You're not supposed to laugh at that. And yet, I found myself just chortling when I got to that scene.
Well, I think the basis of the humor in the Prezi books is that there's no one in the books except organized criminals or partly organized. And they all speak the same, and they all react the same, and therefore, when you're viewing it from outside, this group, they seem to be humorous. And I don't think there's more than three jokes in both books. It's humor that comes out of the character.
You did something really unusual with Prezi's family, which is your new book. You've made it a sequel, but yet you've gone back in time. Tell me exactly how this came about.
Well, for one thing, I had a curiosity about Partana and where he came from, and in the Prezi's honor, there is this explosive reference to the fact that he and Mayrose had been engaged and that they had split up. And I thought that it would be worthwhile to tell in detail why they split up. Then one thing led to another, and there were scenes in Prezi's honor that were one and two paragraphs that I expanded. And they were all telling more and more about Partana. Now, when I started to write the book, I was determined to loose myself from Jack Nicholson's characterization of Partana, because I had described Partana in the book quite differently. But Jack's characterization was so masterful that as I wrote the book, there was no way to escape it.
So, in effect, Jack Nicholson in the second book at least almost set the pattern for Charlie.
Oh, indeed, yes, because we go back to his boyhood, his term in the army in Vietnam, and his early years. Oh, let's say because in the book he's 29 or 30. His entire development and his entire relationship from first meeting with Mayrose is all fleshed out and filled in.
Logically, you could read Prezi's family first and...
The intention is that if eventually the two books would be produced in one volume, that Prezi's family would start the thing and then would come Prezi's honor.
Well, what about a third sequel? Would this go forward or backward in time?
Well, we have to say it in only one way. I am a professional writer, and I write for a living. And right now, the American pub publisher and the English pub publisher are both making discreet inquiries about whether there will be a third. So I've begun to think about whether there should be, and I've reached the point where I at least have a title. It's called Preetzi's Glory. And the theme of the three books then would be that money demands respectability.
Well, this Preetzi's Glory, will this go back?
No, this will go on after Preetzi's honor up until about 1995.
Well, you've gotten onto something with the Preetzi family, because previously I could say without impunity that your most famous book was The Manchurian Candidate, and you're still always going to be known for that book. That's certainly, in spite of all the other good books you've written, the most predominant book. But I have a feeling that of course, that was a terrific movie with The Manchurian Candidate.
Well, it was wonderful. They were both wonderful movies. They were exemplar. Manchurian Candidate was a model of a movie. And now again, I think John Huston has made a model with Preetzi's honor. There's no two ways about it.
In a way, the book and the movie feed on themselves, don't they? Each one publicizes the other.
I think each one is an echo of the other. Among the things that I've tried to do is in all the books that I've written, I've tried to write about the abuse of power. And I've also been intensely interested in the American mythology. The American mythology being, let's say, movie stars, cowboys, outlaws, etc., etc. Because there's a resounding note, as in Beethoven, the theme recurs and recurs and recurs on each of those three, and surely when you count sports figures and lawyers and doctors, newspaper men, media people I speak of, you have to say that they're part of the American myth. And now, what is a myth? A myth is the thing that the ethos that the people believe and like to think of again and again, which is different from other countries. In Britain, they believe in something else. In France, they believe in something else. And they have their own mythology. I like to write about the American mythology.
One thing you can clear up for me a little bit. I was a little unsure of May Rose's motivation when she staged that huge scene at the wedding. Mm-hmm. Why did she suddenly decide to pull out and do that embarrassing act?
I think it's a lack of skill on the writer's part. The thing, if that had been built up with just one more chapter, so it would have been more believable, because this is the way it works. Whatever the human mind can think of, human beings can do. But the little bridge that has to be crossed over is the bridge of believability. Now, if the craft of the writer makes it possible for the reader to believe wholly that that happened, he'll know what happened. And I think I was just too abrupt about the May Rose thing. I thought in my own mind, I thought I had left a trail of clues along the line that would indicate that she cared much more about Charlie than he cared about her, and that she saw that he was in a weak way rejecting her. And she made that final decision to just cut the cord and make it so definite that there was no possible way that he would not be off the hook.
Well, she did that, but she also wound up isolating herself from Brooklyn.
Oh, no, but you also forget the clues that she had had her name changed legally years back to Mary Price. She was the daughter of Edward S. Price, born Eduardo Prizzi. He was a great, great captain of industry. She was a highly respected member of the interior decorating community of this respected Price family, so that she had a haven to go to. And who knows, she might have decided that she had outgrown Brooklyn.
Most people do. Now, did you have a hand in the movie version of Prizzi's Honor?
Yes, I co-wrote the screenplay.
Ah, of course, you've had a wide background in film, haven't you?
Oh, yes, but as a press agent, I had never attempted to write a film before, and if I hadn't had the opportunity to work with Houston, who I think is the greatest cinematic storyteller of all time, that I wouldn't have attempted it. But it seemed to me that the story was clearly cinematic, and that John would be able to smooth out the rough edges.
Since you wrote both the screenplay and the book, what are the differences in approach in trying to do either? I mean, how is the approaching the screenplay as a play, as a writing job, different from the book?
Well, for example, in writing a novel, you have that introspection on the part of each character, their inner life, and in I told Charlie's story from inside his mind, and I told the same viewpoint of Irene Walker, the other professional killer. John decided that there was no need to tell the story of Irene Walker from inside, that we would just tell the story from Partena's viewpoint. And don't forget that there is a limitation of length in film. They have to bring the thing in for about 2 hours and 11 minutes. So that film is not at all introspective, and novels are introspective.
You note that you were a publicist for many years with Disney. Did you, I wanted to ask you this briefly. I don't want to go into a lot of detail because I really want to focus on you, but I did happen to do a report on the air recently, a new biography of Walt Disney, a very controversial book. What was Disney like in your association with him?
He was he's the only innocent I've ever met in my life. He was a man who made those pictures. Now, I came to work for him before Snow White, on the last of the short subjects that included Ferdinand the Bull and the Practical Pig and so things like that. And I learned from observation early on that he made those pictures only for himself. He didn't make them for an audience. He made those pictures with the feeling that if he entertained himself, he could entertain anyone. Now, a good example is on this little short called The Practical Pig. I was a promotion man, I made a tie-up with 8,700 pork stores in the United States for National Pork Week. And each store put a little one-sheet poster in the window that advertised The Practical Pig and sold their pork behind that. Well, he was horrified. And he said, "Dick," he said, those pigs are our actors." He said, supposing you went into Louis B. Mayer and you said, "Mr. Mayer, I've just made a tie-up with the National Undertakers Association for Clark Gable at Greer Garson." He said, "What do you think L.B. Mayer would have said to you?" And I must say that among the man's many other charms, he didn't fire me.
Well, he did fire a lot of other people, and I understand that he was a difficult man to work with, and he underpaid his people terribly.
That isn't true. Now, the National Wages and Hours Commission in the 1960s established that the hourly wage nationally should be, oh, somewhere in the neighborhood of 65 cents an hour. Walt was paying about $1.50 an hour. Now, we have to go along with the times that these things happen in, and you have to go along with the innocence of this man, political innocence, and certainly economic innocence, so that when 71 and 72 came along and the Arabs controlled the oil and the inflation arrived and all these things skyrocketed, that this man who had been paying so much more than the minimum hourly wage was suddenly required to pay maybe five times that. And undoubtedly, it upset him. He was unable to make the two things come together because he was not a man of the world in any sense.
Well, I know those are still probably very good days and very exciting days for you.
But... Oh, wonderful days! And I was there in the time when they were at the old Hyperion Avenue studio where they produced most of Snow White, if not all of it, part of Bambi, part of Pinocchio, and then they moved out to this place in the valley next to Warner's. And you know, you just can't believe that there were 4,000 cars in the parking lot one afternoon, and the next day there were 12 because he was struck by, you can't believe this either, the Sign Painters Guild of Brooklyn struck him because the CIO was trying to get a foothold in the motion picture industry, and the AFL had organized every other studio, and if they got into his studio, the AFL would have been threatened. So the CIA, as a matter of tactics, struck the studio. Well, it was the most alarming thing you can imagine. He could not comprehend that this had happened, no matter who explained it to him, no matter how it was explained. And his explanation for it was, I never should have let them call me Walt. He felt that if the entire staff had referred to him as Mr. Disney, that this thing would not have happened.
Mr. Condon, you have been doing a lot of food writing over the past number of years. I think you even had a recipe book with your daughter.
Well, I had a Mexican cookbook, a thing called The Mexican Stove. It's just about to be republished by the Texas Monthly Press. And it's a very authentic Mexican cookbook that has the longest foreword in cookbook history. It has a 45,000 word foreword. I wrote the foreword, and Wendy wrote all of the food section of the book.
You could publish the foreword separately as a novel.
Oh dear! Almost, no, except it was all true.
Do you do some of your own cooking?
No, I'm a terrible cook. I have no patience in that.
But you're a good eater.
Oh, great eater! Yes,
especially Mexican food.
I don't know if I'm even a great eater. I think that part of the duty of a novelist is to appeal to the five senses constantly, just to refer them to the reader and have the reader refer them back again. And food is one of those things that combines old taste, smell, sight, and feeling.
I understand that you were a pioneer word processor user.
Yeah, I was the second the second novelist to use word processing. John Hersey was the first, and he borrowed his from Yale University. I was in Ireland. This was in 1976 when I bought a word processor, and they sent me to a school in England for 4 days to learn how to use the thing. I never did learn how. And now I'm into even a more advanced one that can do about 320 moves, and I can do about 60 of them.
What do you use now?
I use what they call a dedicated word processor. That means that it's not a computer that can be programmed to use word processing. It can only do word processing.
Does it use disk?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, now, when you did Fritzi's Family, did it all fit on a single disk?
Two disks.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. About a disk and three quarters. Yeah.
Well, how did you organize it, by chapter? Your chapters are very short. Did you break up on the disk individual files as chapters, or just straight through?
No, the idea of the short chapters is the idea of the attention span of a reader who, A, has to get the children to the dentist, who has to keep a bowling appointment, who has about 4,700 problems a day and about 6,000 messages coming through from all sides. I do the short chapters because the attention span is curtailed by these messages and by all of these jobs that people have to do, plus television. So I think, well, I it's just a theory of mine, but I think a short chapter is better than a long one.
I just read a book recently that had no chapters at all. It was a thick book, too. And
oh, sure.
And I always keep a bookmark so I can, because I'm picking up a book and putting it down constantly. But I like to stop at a given point.
Yeah, that's right. It's not the same.
And I couldn't. And I kept reading and said, I got to stop soon. You know, I kept thumbing through the book.
Yes.
And there were no chapters. It was an interesting novel. It was very surrealistic, but it had no chapters at all. Well, I understand that you use the names of your friends in your books. You sneak in the names
I don't sneak them in. In my second book, I used the characters of two friends. One was Franklin Heller, and the other one was Ben Reyes. And they, Ben Reyes was in some business that had to do allied with the printing trades, and he caused about 100 certificates to be made, and the certificates were to the International Confederation of Book Actors. And they were dedicated to people who had always intended to star in stage, screen, or opera, but they had to make a living. But then, through their agents, they consented to appear in my novels. So we now have about 67 members of the International Confederation of Book Actors. But they're, on the other hand, you know, they're people that I met in Hong Kong. They're people that I knew in Ireland there. And when they're used, they're always cast against type. I mean, a doctor will appear as a cab driver and so forth. And so far, not one has complained.
Well, I hope you have no friends named Preetzy.
Well, you know, about a week after the first book came out, I had a call from a young woman in North Dakota, and she said, my name is Preetzy, and my father wanted to ask you if we could be related to those people. And I said, well, I don't think so, but I chose the name Preetzy from an atlas of Sicily, and it's a village about central Sicily. And it's quite possible that your family came from the town of Preetzy.
Well, I'm glad they weren't related, for their sake. Well, it's another winner from Richard Condon. You keep turning out the books. I think you have more than 20 novels to your credit now.
I think 22, and two nonfiction books.
And more on your word processor.
I should think so. I should hope so.
Richard Condon, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Don.